Hello and welcome. We are about to engage in specific discussions regarding contracts. And last time we delved into the wonderful world of contracts for the first time. We talked about rights in contracts, your freedom to contract, which is so fundamentally important because if you want to pursue a special career or you want to go down the line of being able to operate a business, be able to buy a house, all these things involve contracts. And, you know, even so much as buying a car, your freedom of contract is very valuable. We discussed that last time. We discussed about the common law of contracts. Most of the law of contracts is state law because it was founded in common law and it came over from England. We talked about a definition of what a contract is. It's an agreement. We talked about what the elements of a contract were. We talked about the nature of contracts. Then we talked about contract formation. Remember, a contract, which is an agreement, requires an offer and an acceptance. And those two elements are critically important. If you have an offer, you have an acceptance, that's what comes to an agreement. And lastly, we wrapped up our discussions last time with a discussion about Colchins v. Evolution Market. And as you remember, that was the case involving the employment contract and what the elements of a contract are, and recognizing them, whether or not there's a, quote, meeting of the minds together. Remember, they had the emails go back and forth and whether or not a contract was actually established. And that offer and that acceptance is what's paramount because it shows what we call a genuine assent, meaning that they have an agreement. Well, tonight, we're going to talk about contractual capacity, which basically says you have the ability to understand what the agreement is. Because without that ability to understand what the agreement is, then there's no contract because you have no genuine assent. We're going to talk about mistakes because mistakes can do away with that genuine assent and hence not have an agreement. And lastly, tonight, we're going to talk about deception and pressure. You know, sometimes you can be forced into a contract or tricked into a contract or misled. And as a result of that, that doesn't have genuine assent because you're not really agreeing to it. You're being required to or tricked into it. And lastly, we're going to go through our case tonight, Gerstein v. Broad Hollow Company, which was a real estate firm in Long Island. And I'll talk about your free will to contract and is there duress out there? And let's get started. Jump right in. Here we go. We're going to talk first about contractual capacity, your actual ability mentally to be able to understand the contract and to be able to enter into the contract. Let's start out with our definitions. Remember, what is a definition of a contract? It's an agreement between two or more parties creating obligations that are enforceable or otherwise recognizable by law. So it's an agreement. That's the fundamental concept of a contract. It has to be between competent parties. That's where the element of capacity comes in, because the people have to be able to understand the contract. And if there's not competence there, there's not capacity, which means they're not able to understand it. So if you don't understand it, you don't have a contract. You don't have an agreement. which is the fundamental underpinnings of what a contract is. It's got to be based on genuine assent, and that is related to capacity. If you don't understand the contract, how can you genuinely agree to it? It's got to be supported by consideration, which we'll get into in future lectures. It's got to be for a lawful purpose. You can't have a contract that's illegal. And it's got to be in legal form. Some contracts, as we discussed the last time, have to be in writing. Some have to be what we call under seal, which is a special type of signature requirement. And most contracts don't, but some contracts do. So it has to meet that legal form. The biggest standard is when you have a contract which is subject to the statute of frauds. Those have to be in writing and signed by the party to be charged. Let's get into some of these definitions with respect to capacity, because that's what we're going to kick off with tonight. To be a valid contract, it must be between competent parties. What is competence? What does that mean? It's a basic or minimal ability to do something. Legal competency is based on the concept of capacity. The power to create or enter into a legal relation under the same circumstances in which a normal person would have the power to do so. Age and mental health are both elements of capacity. Let's get into that further. Contractual capacity has been defined as the ability to understand that a contract is being made. First and foremost, you have to understand there's an agreement here that's being presented to you, and to comprehend its general meaning. You understand not only that there's a contract, but what it means as far as your obligations, your duties, your responsibilities, and your benefits, and your detriments. You have to understand that to the extent that genuine assent may be given to its terms. If you don't understand that this is a contract, if you don't understand its general meaning, you're not going to give that genuine assent. Why? Because you don't understand what you're agreeing to. So you may be giving an assent, but it's not genuine. Okay? So as a result of that, you have to look at capacity about the ability to understand, number one, that a contract's being made, and two, to comprehend its general meaning. It's a two-step dance on that. What elements are there of capacity? Well, there's two types of incapacity, meaning you don't have capacity. One is minors. Children cannot appreciate all the elements of a contract. They can't appreciate how much money or how much time or how difficult it is or how expensive something is. And they don't have the legal capacity as a result over the course of the common law to contract. So if you are a minor, you generally do not have the legal ability to contract. Now, we make exceptions here because what we'll do with minors is say if a person who's over 18, who's not a minor, contracts with a minor understanding that they're a minor and is willing to take that risk, they'll allow the contract to go forward. And under those terms, the contract is what we call voidable. That means the minor gets to say, okay, I can contract with it, but if I figure out I didn't have a good deal or I don't want to do it or I change my mind, they can stop the contract. They can what they call void, make the contract voidable, which means I can have rescission, meaning I can get out of it. Contracts with minors are voidable at the option of the minor. Now, generally, people who are of the age of majority, somebody over 18, won't contract with a minor as a result. Why? Because they can always get out. What kind of contract do you have where the other party can always get out? So you have to know that going in, and that's one of the reasons on it. Now, sometimes you have minors for whatever reason. they've been legally emancipated from their parents. That means they're on their own, you know, frequently they're working or they have left the home. Sometimes they're in the military. And as a result of that, these emancipated minors are presumed to have capacity, but that's not a big exception. Generally, people under 18, that's the legal age of majority in New York State, do not have capacity to contract. That's called status incapacity. Factual incapacity is mental incompetence. That's due to mental illness. You know, you're schizophrenic, brain injury. Yeah, you have had some injury to your brain or some disease that has caused that brain injury, so you're not of full faculties. Or if you're intoxicated, and you can be intoxicated from medication, from illegal drugs, or from alcohol. And as a result of that, factual incapacity also makes you lack capacity. Again, the reasoning behind all this, why do we require capacity? Why do we care? It's because of genuine assent. Genuine assent is that the agreement or the approval or permission is authentic, real, and has the quality of what it's purported to be. So you're saying, I agree to this and I understand that. I want to go forward with that contract. Well, if you don't have capacity, you can't do that. Capacity takes away your ability to provide genuine assent. And as the ability of the parties to understand the terms, conditions, duties, and responsibilities of the contract, which they're engaging in, if it's called in question due to their age or mental illness or brain injury or intoxication, then they really can't agree to it. And that's why we care about capacity. Now, who's a minor? Under Section 2 of the Domestic Relations Law, as well as provisions of the state and national constitutions, a person who is under the age of 18 is deemed as a minor who is not of what we call the age of majority. The age of majority is that you can enter into contracts, you can vote, you can do things on your own, you're considered legally an adult. The age of majority in New York State is 18 years of age. If you're below that, you're considered a minor, you're considered a child. And as a result of that, you don't have the power to contract other than what we specified before. Some people can engage in a contract with you, but you can always get out of it because you can void it because you're not of 18 years of age. A minor or a person with some other insufficient capacity may disaffirm or avoid the contract by demonstrating that they have an express intent to repudiate it. I didn't know what I was doing. I'm too young to understand it. And that expression is known as a disaffirmance. For the minor, it can be done while the person is a minor. And for others, it can be done by a third party or legal representative. It has to be done within a reasonable time. Okay? It can't be done 10 years down the road. A minor's misrepresentation of their age, said I am 18, doesn't affect the power to disaffirm. That seems unfair, but it is the law. And it's the reason being that the person engaging with the minor should have proven that, should have understood how old they were and gotten some degree of proof for that. And their failure to do that, the fact that the minor misrepresented their age, they do that all the time because they want to get into the contract, doesn't mean that They don't have the ability to disaffirm because they still do. Minors are generally regarded as not having capacity to contract. Issues avoiding the avoidable contracts include that if you do go down and say, I want to avoid, I want to disaffirm as a minor, you must make restitution. That means if you were given money as part of it, as a consideration, they have to give the money back. The intent is to provide for what we call a status quo ante, which means you put the parties back to where they were. If the original consideration has been damaged, destroyed, or exhausted, that means the money's been spent. The minor can still disaffirm the contract, but must return whatever is left, the remainder of the consideration on that. And if it's all been spent and all gone, they can still disaffirm, but the problem is on that, the other party should recognize they were contracting with a minor and that was the risk they were taking. Recovery of property by the minor on avoidance. When a minor disaffirms the contract, the other contracting party must also return the money or property received. So basically what a disaffirmance does is it cancels the contract. And in canceling it, both parties have to return what they received. You try and put the parties back to where they were. Sometimes that's not always possible, but by and large, that's what the law tries to do here. Contracts for necessaries, as they're called in the law. Sometimes a minor will contract for what he deems is a necessary. That means things like food, things like shelter, things that you absolutely have to have as a human being. Over the course of time, the rule has been extended to also health care and education and comfort of the minor. That is more the exception than the rule, to be honest with you. And as a result of that, when you have a contract for necessaries, the minor can usually disaffirm the contract, but has to pay for it. Whereas in the other provisions with other non-necessary items, such as the minor buys a car, you have to return the car, but at the end of the day, they don't have to keep making car payments on it. With respect to necessaries, if you buy shelter, you buy food, things like that, you still have to make the payments. You have to pay back the other party. Necessaries are a specific area in the law. And interestingly enough, when a third person supplies parents of a guardian or of the minor with necessaries on behalf of the minor, that parent cannot terminate the contract. They can't turn around and disaffirm. Why? Because the contract's with them and they're an adult. That doesn't mean a parent is liable all the time for necessaries being provided, because the law is held that where the parent can't pay for the necessary that the minor has contracted for, that the minor still has to pay for. A ratification of a minor's voidable contract. When the minor becomes of an age of majority, when they turn 18, they can ratify the contract, say that is a good contract, and then it becomes completely enforceable. Or they can disaffirm it, and which in that case, that means the contract doesn't go forward, as we just talked about. A person can disaffirm a contract at any time during their minority, and for a reasonable time after that, they can ratify the contract only after they become 18, Why? Because before that, it has no power because they're still a child. The minor must have attained the age of majority in order to ratify it, but they can disaffirm the contract at any time and for a brief time after they hit the age of majority, which is classified as a reasonable time that is related to the nature of the contract, how long it is, what it's for, so on and so forth. Certain contracts, the courts have found under common law and that minors cannot disaffirm. The biggest one is student loans. They are responsible for student loans. Sometimes they're responsible for medical care contracts. Not always, but sometimes. Contracts when made by a minor who is running a business. Well, they're deemed, but under the law, if they're responsible enough to run a business, then they're responsible enough to enter into a contract, and they can't run the business without entering into the contracts generally. So those contracts are generally held to be not able to be disaffirmed. Any contract that's been approved by a court, because the court's already reviewed that, they've looked at the parties, they said, yeah, this person is a minor, but this contract ought to be approved anyway. That contract cannot be disaffirmed. A contract made in performance of a legal duty, that's very similar, because even though it may not have been approved by a court, it's approved under the law. And contracts relating to certain bank accounts, insurance policies, or stock proceeds. Now, a minor in New York State, and indeed anyone under 21, cannot own in their own name corporate stock. But there's certain contracts regarding corporate stock, as well as insurance policies and bank accounts, that cannot be disaffirmed as a matter of law. Why? Because otherwise, these individuals who might need these things, such as bank accounts and insurance policies, couldn't have them. And there's a lot of reasons why minors need those things. And as a result, those are exceptions to the disaffirmance rule. Now, mentally incompetent persons are a person with a mental disease, a mental defect, or who are intoxicated and may be so disabled as they can't make a contract. Now, if those people are generally classified as persons under what we call diminished capacity. Now, unlike a minor who just simply by, that's why they're called status, just by their age is not able to contract. They're not deemed of capacity because of their age. Mental incompetency, on the other hand, is a much more fuzzy type of circumstance because particularly with intoxication, that can be a temporary condition. And with mental disease and defect, those things can sometimes be cured. Mental diseases, particularly if somebody goes on medication, sometimes they get better. Mental defect, depending on what is causing it. Sometimes people will heal from brain injuries, sometimes not. And the severity of it all comes into question too. Incompetency is defined under the mental hygiene law in kind of a very broad term. And if you're found unable to manage your own affairs, and it's somewhat simple of a concept. If you can't handle your own affairs, then you're deemed to be incompetent for purposes of contract. At the end of the day, that's a pretty fuzzy definition because it's somewhat subjective on that. what's the effect of an incompetency? An incompetent person may ordinarily avoid a contract in the same manner as a minor. If you are found to be incompetent, if you have a mental disease or a mental defect or were intoxicated at the time the contract was made, this is a defense to the contract. When somebody's going after and trying enforcing that contract against you. You say, hey, listen, I had a mental disease. I didn't have capacity. I had a mental defect. I had a brain injury. I had a encephalitis, which was causing me to be confused, or I was intoxicated. I was on a medication that caused me to be very confused or not understand what was going on. This actually happened with my mother-in-law. She was on medication that caused her ammonia levels in her blood to rise. No one recognized it, and it caused her to lose her faculties as a result. The ammonia levels kept going up, and she didn't have them tested and wasn't aware of it, and was not able to process information at all because of this condition. They took her off that medication. They actually changed it. The ammonia levels went down, and she got perfectly lucid again. So if you have anyone with competency issues, one of the things you should do is check their ammonia levels. I got my mother-in-law's mental and personality 100% back. It was a wonderful thing, but it was a very sad thing at the time it occurred. Any time while she was on that medication and those ammonia levels were spiking, she would not have been able to contract. She wouldn't have been able to understand anything because of the fact that she would have been a mental incompetent. And any court would have adjudicated her as that. And that's generally what is required for mental incompetency. Not always, but generally. There's got to be some kind of determination that that person is not, that's why this is generally raised as a defense, but that they're not competent. Because unlike age, which is a delineation point, you know if somebody is above the age of 18 or not, with respect to mental incompetence, that is a systematic kind of symptomatic area. You have to look at that person to say, are they of this problem? Now, if someone has a mental defect, that's a little bit easier because you can demonstrate physiologically if they have brain damage or brain illness or some kind of brain injury. But if it's merely because of mental illness or because of intoxication, that is harder to be able to come up with physiological functions on that. Now, obviously, you can do a drug test, you could do a blood alcohol test, but different people react to drugs and alcohol differently. And whereas some people could have six drinks and not be affected mentally, other people, after having two beers, are. So, you know, it is a factual type of circumstance. Now, generally, if a person has these issues on an ongoing basis, the court, their family members or the opposing party can move for the appointment of a guardian. And whereupon a guardian is appointed, that person is deemed as not having competency, and their contracts can thereupon be disaffirmed. Absent that, it's a case-by-case basis. Okay. What is intoxication? Intoxication is a diminished ability to act with full mental and physical capabilities because of either alcohol or drug consumption. Sometimes this is perfectly legal consumption, sometimes it isn't. And if you, first, it's the test that we discussed before. Do you know that there's a contract? Some people are so drugged, some people are so drunk that they don't even know they're entering into a contract. And in which case, they can later come back and say, hey, I was out of my mind. I didn't know. I blacked out. I didn't understand it. I had my faculties impaired by either alcohol or drugs. And the drugs can be legal, as we said. I mean, if you have certain medications that do this or have side effects that do this, that can cause this problem too. If the degree of intoxication is such that the person did not know that a contract was being made, then the contract's voidable. And thereafter, upon becoming sober, that means the drugs are out of their system, or the effect of the intoxication is gone, the individual may avoid or rescind the contract. Say, I didn't even know it was a contract. An unreasonable delay in that, however, if you become sober and are sober for a long period of time, then you can't disaffirm. Because you recognized it when you were sober and then went forward, or when you were sober, rather, and then went forward anyway. Excessive intoxication is a viable defense to contracts, arising particularly out of casinos, because it happens a lot there, because they tend to offer you alcohol in order to lubricate your wallet and be able to have you bet more often. It is a viable defense to those contracts. Thus, when a casino comes to enforce a marker debt against a patron and then seeks to enforce that contractual debt, the patron is often entitled to raise that defense. It should be noted that courts treat impairment caused by the use of drugs the same as alcohol. It doesn't matter why you are intoxicated, only that you are. Why is this? It's a capacity issue. In order to have a valid contract, you have to have genuine assent. If you don't know you're making the contract or don't understand its terms, and that can be with respect to persons who are underage or persons who are of diminished capacity, either by brain injury or mental illness or intoxication, you don't have genuine assent. And without genuine assent, you don't have a contract. That's it for this portion of the lecture. And we thank you for listening. And now we're going to go on to mistakes. See you in a bit.